Chapter 2. Here's what the Encyclopedia Galactica has to say about alcohol. It says that alcohol is a colorless, volatile liquid formed by fermentation of sugars, and also notes its intoxicating effect on certain carbon-based life forms. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy also mentions alcohol. It says that the best drink in existence is the Pan-Galactic Gargle Blaster. It says that the effect of drinking a Pan-Galactic Gargle Blaster is like having your brain smashed out by a slice of lemon wrapped around a large gold brick. The guide also tells you on which planets the best Pan-Galactic Gargle Blasters are mixed, how much you can expect to pay for one, and what voluntary organizations exist to help you rehabilitate afterward. The guide even tells you how you can mix one yourself. Take the juice from one bottle of Old Jank Spirit, it says. Pour into one measure of water from the seas of Serengetus the Fifth. Oh, that Santringinian sea water, it says. Oh, those Santringinian fish. Allow 3 cubes of Arcturan Megawin to melt into the mixture. It must be properly iced or the benzene is lost. Allow 4 liters of Fallian marsh gas to bubble through it in memory of all those happy hikers who have died of pleasure in the marshes of Fallia. Over the back of a silver spoon, float a measure of Qualicin Hypermixendract, redolent of all the heady odors of the dark Qualactin zones, subtle, sweet, and mystic. Drop in the tooth of an Algonian sun tiger. Watch it dissolve, spreading the fires of the Algonian suns deep into the heart of the drink. Sprinkle zamphoir. Add an olive. Drink, but very carefully. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy sells rather better than the Encyclopedia Galactica. 6 pints of bitter, said Ford Prefect to the barman of the Horse and Groom. And quickly, please, the world's about to end. The barman of the Horse and Groom didn't deserve this sort of treatment. He was a dignified old man. He pushed his glasses up his nose and blinked at the Ford Prefect. Ford ignored him and stared out the window, so the barman looked instead at Arthur, who shrugged helplessly and said nothing. So the barman said, "Oh, yes, sir. Nice weather for it," and started pulling pints. He tried again. "Going to watch the match this afternoon, then?" Ford glanced around him. "No, no point," he said, and looked back out the window. "What's that foregone conclusion, then, you reckon, sir?" said the barman. "Arsenal without a chance?" "No, no," said Ford. "It's just that the world's about to end." "Ah, yes, sir, so you said," said the barman, looking over his glasses this time at Arthur. "Lucky escape for the Arsenal, if it did." Ford looked back at him, genuinely surprised. "No, not really," he said. He frowned. The barman breathed in heavily. "There you are, sir, 6 pints, he said. Arthur smiled at him wanly and shrugged again. He turned and smiled wanly at the rest of the pub, just in case any of them had heard what was going on. None of them had, and none of them could understand what he was smiling for. A man sitting next to Ford at the bar looked at the 2 men, looked at the 6 pints, did a swift burst of mental arithmetic, arrived at an answer he liked, grinned a stupid hopeful grin at them. "Get off," said Ford. "They're ours," giving him a look that would have made an Algonian sun tiger get on what he was doing. Ford slapped a 5-pound note on the bar. He said, "Keep the change." "What, from a fiver? Thank you, sir. You've got 10 minutes left to spend it." The barman decided to simply walk away for a bit. "Ford," said Arthur, "would you please tell me what the hell is going on?" "Drink up," said Ford. "You've got 3 pints to get through." 3 pints, said Arthur. "At lunchtime?" The man next to Ford grinned and nodded happily. Ford ignored him. He said, "Time is an illusion. Lunchtime doubly so." "Very deep," said Arthur. "You should send that to Reader's Digest. They've got a page for people like you. Drink up. Why 3 pints all of a sudden? Muscle relaxant. You'll need it. Muscle relaxant? Muscle relaxant. Arthur stared into his beer. Did I do anything wrong today, he said, or has the world always been like this and I've been too wrapped up in myself to notice? All right, said Ford, I'll try to explain. How long have we known each other? How long, Arthur said. Maybe 5 years? Six? He said. Most of it seemed to make that kind of sense at the time. All right, said Ford. How would you react if I said that I'm not from Guildford after all, but from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse? Arthur shrugged in a so-so sort of way. I don't know, he said, taking a pull of beer. Why do you think it's the sort of thing you're likely to say? Ford gave up. It really wasn't worth bothering at that moment. What with the world about to end, he just said, drink up. He added, perfectly frankly, the world's about to end. Arthur gave the rest of the pub another wan smile. The rest of the pub frowned at him. A man waved at him and to stop smiling at them and mind his own business. This must be Thursday, said Arthur to himself, sinking lower over his beer. I never could get the hang of Thursdays. Chapter 3. On this particular Thursday, something was moving quietly through the ionosphere many miles above the surface of the planet. Several somethings, in fact, several dozen huge, yellow, chunky, slab-like somethings, huge as office blocks, silent as birds. They soared with ease, basking in the electromagnetic rays from the star soul, biding their time, grouping, preparing. The planet beneath them was almost perfectly oblivious to their presence, which was just how they wanted it for the moment. The huge yellow something went unnoticed as, goonhilly, they passed over Cape Canaveral without a blip. Woomera and Jodrell Bank looked straight through them, which was a pity because it was exactly the sort of thing they'd been looking for all these years. The only place they registered at all was on a small black device called a sub-ether-sansomatic, which winked very quietly at itself. It nestled in the darkness inside a leather satchel which Ford Prefect habitually wore slung around his neck. The contents of Ford Prefect's satchel were quite interesting, in fact, and would have made any Earth physicist's eyes pop out of his head, which is why he always concealed them by keeping a couple of dog-eared scripts for plays he pretended he was auditioning for, stuffed in the top. Besides the sub-ether sensomatic and the scripts, he had electronic thumb. A short, squat, black rod, smooth and matte with a couple of flat switches and dials at one end. He also had a device that looked rather like a largest electromagnetic calculator. This had about 100 tiny flat press buttons and a screen about 4 inches square in which any one of a million pages could be summoned at a moment's notice. It looked insanely complicated, and this was one of the reasons why the snug plastic cover it fitted into had the words "Don't Panic" printed on it in large, friendly letters. The other reason was that this device was in fact the most remarkable of all books ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The reason why it was published in the form of a micro-sub Mason electronic component is that if it were printed on a normal book, an interstellar hitchhiker would require several inconveniently large buildings to carry it around in. Beneath that in Ford Prefect's satchel were a few ballpoint pens, a notepad, and the largest bath towel from Marks & Spencer. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has a few things to say on the subject of towels. A towel, it says, is about the most massively useful thing an interstellar hitchhiker can have. Partly, it has great practical value. You can wrap it around you for warmth as you bound across the cold moons of Jungla Beta. You can lie on it in the brilliant marble-sanded beaches of Centriangus V, inhaling the heady sea vapors. You can sleep under it beneath the stars which shine so redly in the desert world of Kakrafoon. Use it to sail a mine raft down the slowly heavy River Moth. Wet it for use in hand-to-hand combat. Wrap it around your head to ward off noxious fumes or avoid the gaze of ravenous bug bladder beast of trail, a mind-bogglingly stupid animal. It assumes that if you can't see it, it can't see you. Daft as a brush, but very, very ravenous. You can wave your towel in emergencies as a distress signal, and of course dry yourself off with it if it still seems to be clean enough. More importantly, a towel has immense psychological value. For some reason, if a strag non-hitchhiker, discovers that a hitchhiker has his towel with him, he will automatically assume that he is also in possession of a toothbrush, a washcloth, soap, a tin of biscuits, a flask, a compass, map, ball of string for gnat spray, wet weather gear, spacesuit, etc., etc. Furthermore, the strag will then happily lend the hitchhiker any of these or a dozen other items that the hitchhiker might accidentally have lost. What the strag will think is that any man who can hitch the length and the breadth of the galaxy, rough it, slum it, struggle against the terrible odds, win through it, and still know where his towel is, clearly is a man to be reckoned with. Hence a phrase that has passed into the hitchhiking slang as in, "Hey, you sass, that hoopy Ford prefect? There's a frood who really knows where his towel is. Sass. Know, beware of, meet, have sex with. Hoopy? Rather to other guy. Frood? Rather amazingly together guy." Nestling quietly on top of the towel and Ford prefect satchel, the sub-FS sensomatic began to wink more quickly. Miles above the surface of the planet, the huge yellow somethings began to fan out. At Jodrell Bank, something decided it was time for a nice, relaxing cup of tea. "You got a towel with you?" said Ford suddenly to Arthur. Arthur, struggling through his third pint, looked round him. "Why? What? No. Should I have?" He had given up being surprised. There didn't seem to be any point any longer. Ford clicked his tongue in irritation. "Drink up," he urged. At that moment, the dull sound of a rumbling crash from outside filtered through the low murmur of the pub. Through the sound of the jukebox, through the sound of the man next to Ford hiccuping over the whiskey Ford had eventually bought him. Arthur choked on his beer and leapt to his feet. "What's that?" he yelped. "Don't worry," said Ford. "They haven't started yet." "Thank God for that," said Arthur and relaxed. "It's probably just your house being knocked down," said Ford, downing his last pint. "What?" shouted Arthur. Suddenly, Ford's spell was broken. Arthur looked wildly around him and ran to the window. "My God, they are! They're knocking my house down! What the hell am I doing here at the pub?" "It hardly makes any difference at this stage," said Ford. "Let them have their fun." "Fun!" yelled Arthur. "Fun!" He quickly checked out the window again, and they were talking about the same thing. "Damn their fun," he hooted, and ran out of the pub furiously, waving a nearly empty beer glass. He made no friends at all in the pub that lunchtime. "Stop, you vandals! You home wreckers!" bawled Arthur. "You half-grades Visgoths! Stop, will you?" Ford could have gone with him. Turning quickly to the barman, he asked for 4 packets of peanuts. "There you are, sir," said the barman, slapping the packets on the bar. 28 pence, if you're so kind." Ford was very kind, and he gave the barman another 5-pound note and told him to keep the change. The barman looked at it and then looked at Ford. He suddenly shivered. He experienced momentary sensations that he didn't understand, because no one on earth had ever experienced it before. In moments of great stress, every life form that exists gives out a tiny subliminal signal. This signal simply communicates an exact and almost pathetic sense of how far that being is from his place on his birth. On Earth, it is never possible to be further than 16,000 miles from your birthplace, which really isn't very far, so such signals are too minute to be noticed. Ford Prefect was at this moment under great stress, and he was born 600 light-years away in the near vicinity of Betelgeuse. The barman reeled for a moment and hit by a shocking, incomprehensible sense of distance. He didn't know what it meant, but he looked at Ford Prefect with a new sense of respect, almost awe. "Are you serious, sir?" he said in a small whisper, which had the effect of silencing the pub. "You think the world's going to end?" "Yes," said Ford. "But this afternoon..." Ford had recovered himself. He was at his flippest. "Yes," he said gaily. "In less than 2 minutes, I would estimate." The barman couldn't believe this conversation he was having, but he couldn't believe the sensation he had just had either. "Isn't there something we can do about it, then?" he said. "No, nothing," said Ford, stuffing the peanuts in his pocket. Somewhere in the hushed bar, suddenly, someone laughed raucously at how stupid everything had become. The man sitting next to Ford was a bit sozzled by now. His eyes weaved their way up to Ford. "I thought," he said, "that if the world was going to end, we were meant to lie down or put a paper bag over our head or something." "If you like, yes," said Ford. "That's what they told us in the army," said the man, and his eyes began to long trek backward toward the whiskey. "Will that help?" asked the barman. "No," said Ford, and gave him a friendly smile. "Excuse me," he said, "I've got to go." With a wave, he left. The pub was silent for a moment longer, and then, embarrassingly enough, the man with a raucous laugh did it again. The girl he had dragged along to the pub with him had grown to loathe him dearly over the last hour, and it would probably have been a great satisfaction for her to know that in a minute and a half or so he would suddenly evaporate into a whiff of hydrogen, ozone, and carbon monoxide. However, when the moment came, she was too busy evaporating herself to notice it. The barman cleared his throat. He heard himself say, "Last orders, please." The huge yellow machines began to sink downward and move faster. Ford knew they were there. This wasn't the way he had wanted it. Running up the lane, Arthur had nearly reached his house. He didn't notice how cold it was and suddenly become, and he didn't notice the wind. He didn't notice the irrational squall of rain. He didn't notice anything but the caterpillar bulldozers crawling over the rubble that had once been his home. "You barbarians," he yelled. "I'll sue the council for every penny it's got. I'll have you hung, drawn, and quartered, and whipped, and boiled, until you've had enough." Ford was running after him very fast. Very, very fast. "And then I will do it again," yelled Arthur. "And when I've finished, I'll take up all the little bits, and I will jump on them." Arthur didn't notice that the men were running from the bulldozers. He didn't notice that Mr. Prosser was staring hectically at the sky. What Mr. Prosser had noticed was that the huge yellow somethings were screaming through the clouds. Impossibly huge yellow somethings. "And I will carry on jumping on them," he yelled, "until I get blisters or can think of anything more unpleasant to do." And then Arthur tripped and he fell headlong, rolled, and landed flat on his back. At last, he noticed that something was going on. His finger shot upward. "What the hell's that?" he shrieked. Whatever it was raced across the sky in its monstrous yellowness, tore the sky apart with mind-boggling noise, and leapt off into the distance, leaving the gaping air to shut behind with a bang that drove your ears 6 feet into your skull. Another one followed, and did exactly the same thing, only louder. It's difficult to say exactly what the people on the surface of the planet were going to do now because, well, they didn't really know what they were doing anyways. None of it made a lot of sense. Running into houses, running out of the houses, howling noiselessly at the noise. All around the city, streets exploded with people. Cars skidded into each other as the noise fell on them. And they rolled off like a tidal wave over hills and valleys, deserts and oceans, seeming to flatten everything it hit. Only one man stood and watched the sky, stood with terrible sadness in his eyes and rubber bungs in his ears. He knew exactly what was happening, and he had known ever since his sub Eda Sensomatic had started winking at the dead of night beside his pillow and wakened him with a start. It was what he had waited for all these years, but when he had deciphered the signal pattern sitting alone in his small dark room, a coldness had gripped him and squeezed his heart. Of all the races in all the galaxy who had come and said a big hello to planet Earth, he thought, it just have to be the Vogans. Still, he knew that what he had to do was, as the Vogan craft screamed through the air high above him, he opened his satchel. He threw away a copy of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. He threw away a copy of Godspell. He wouldn't need them at where he was going. Everything was ready. Everything was prepared. He knew where his towel was.